Pulse 1077 News.
Good morning, 7:30 here on Thursday, November 2nd. I'm Dave Sheldon. This is your Pulse, the Fraser News update. The government of British Columbia has selected PwC Canada to lead an operational review of ICBC to identify waste, find ways to prevent fraud and overbilling, and identify opportunities for business reform at the Crown Corporation. Joining us on the phone lines right now is the Attorney General of the province of BC and also MLA for Vancouver Point Grey. It's David Eby. Good morning, David. Welcome back to the program.
Morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem at all. I want you I kind of gave the overview of what's going on here, but what was the impetus behind looking at ICBC and what's going on?
Well, the backstory, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be familiar with it, is that the corporation, ICBC, which is owned by the public, lost about $500 million last year. And this was surprising news to a lot of people because going into the election, they were under the impression that it was going to lose somewhere around $25 million. And so it's losing a lot of money. It's losing money a lot faster than anybody thought. And some really significant reforms are needed. This review will be very similar to an audit. There'll be 100 files from ICBC that will be pulled randomly and reviewed in depth to identify opportunities for savings. And also, Dave, and this is the remarkable part to me, for the first time, a reviewer like this will be directed to speak to the frontline employees at ICBC, some of whom have spoken out in the media about concerns about billing practices of some firms and other problems that may be leading to cost overruns at the insurer.
There was a quick denial by ICBC about some of these employees' claims, and it was strikingly abrupt right away from ICBC. It's not that they're trying to hide something here, David. At least I don't think they are. But at the same time, I found it quite interesting. There was immediate denial there. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that British Columbians need to have confidence that a company that they own that sets their insurance rates to recover the costs of the company is operating as optimally as possible and that there aren't issues that need to be fixed. And so when somebody shows up in the media and makes these kinds of allegations, they need to have confidence that they're addressed or that there's no basis to them. So that certainly will be addressed in this review. To have a third party come in that's not ICBC to do that review, I think is really important, and that's why we've chosen an outside firm to do it.
Okay, so PwC Canada, and I want to get to this in a second here, but PwC Canada was the firm that you guys went through. How was that process brought upon to this situation, and how did PwC become the people you guys chose?
The government has a list of pre-selected firms that are available to do this kind of work. If you choose a firm from the pre-selected list, you can avoid doing a full call for tenders. If you go out to call for tenders from firms, it can take a couple months to do it. We don't have that kind of time, so we went to the predetermined list. And the only challenge with doing that, from my perspective, was that every single firm on the list had done some kind of work with ICBC before, either a business review of some kind or PricewaterhouseCoopers is actually the financial auditor. They review the annual books for ICBC each year. So they all had some kind of pre-existing relationship with ICBC, whether from the outside or internally. So it wasn't perfect from that perspective, but we needed to move quite quickly. And PwC has set up a number of firewalls internally to ensure that none of the staff are involved from the financial side. It's an entirely different department will be involved in this business review process at all.
So any kind of conflict of interest, you feel confident that this is not going to be a part of that issue?
Exactly right. And PricewaterhouseCoopers has their own reputation to uphold here, and no particular interest is the financial auditor in failing to address any issues that they might find on the business side.
David Eby, our guest, he's the Attorney General of the province of British Columbia. We're talking about ICBC right now. There have been a number of different conversations, David, in regards to what's next for ICBC. I know that we've had the Chris Sims on from Canadian Taxpayers Federation talk about making ICBC a cooperative at some point here. Is there a thought process for you as to what you'd like to see with ICBC as far as it being a more, I don't want to say productive, might be the wrong word for it, but a more sustainable insurance program going forward?
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem. They have a monopoly on basic insurance. They need to at least be breaking even. And you can't be losing $500 million in this kind of an operation. And so when I look at the rates that British Columbians are paying, they're among the highest in Canada. when I look at the losses that the insurer, I can't really make sense of that. So why are we paying really high rates and why is the insurer losing money? So we have a couple of theories about why that's the case. Certainly, there's some pretty major costs and acceleration of costs in auto body repair, in legal expenses, expert reports. And so we're looking at all those issues. We're having very difficult conversations with the stakeholders who are involved in this, with the lawyers, with the auto body repair shops, and with the employees at ICBC, and trying to figure out the best set of reforms to get this thing back on track. The goal for me is to put ICBC back where it used to be, which is providing affordable auto insurance for British Columbians, and some years even generating a little bit of money. And it's important to note that ICBC delivers a lot of public services as part of its mandate, including driver's license services and so on. So I think that we can get ICBC back on track, but the pressure's on. You know, we don't have a lot of time to do it.
Do you think that this got away from us a little bit from the fact that there's a lot more damage out there on vehicles, a lot more exotic cars out in our market now, or a greater volume than we ever thought that the capacity ICBC can handle?
Well, when I get reports from the experts that we've brought in on this about insurance across North America and across the world, a lot of insurers are experiencing a couple of different pressures. One is their investment income is lower than it used to be. Insurers collect the money up front, and then they use the investment income from the insurance policy money that they're holding to offset costs, and that's lower than usual. Auto body repair is more expensive than it used to be. You know, if you have a camera in a bumper and someone rear-ends you, it's more expensive than a bumper without a camera.
Sure.
To repair it, this kind of thing. But there's no question that ICBC, in terms of the losses that it's experiencing right now, is quite singular, and that we have a really serious issue that comes from, in my opinion, two problems of the previous government. One was they were unwilling to have difficult conversations with people who provide services to ICBC or interact with ICBC, like lawyers and auto body repair shops. The other issue was that they were taking money out of ICBC in the years that they thought ICBC was profitable, when in fact ICBC was just deferring claims that were being made to future years. So they emptied out $1.1 billion from the corporation, and that was money that actually should be there right now to be paying claims that are being settled right now, and it was used to balance the budget. So, you know, there were two major problems that the government had previously, and we can't go back in time and fix those things, but what we can do is go forward and address them to make sure that ICBC is back on track.
David Eby, our guest. He's the Attorney General of the Province of British Columbia, also MLA for Vancouver Point Grey. I do want to talk to you about the Human Rights Commission that you mandated has to be put back together. I know Ravi Kalon is doing some work here from Delta North. Where are you guys in regards to this as far as process is concerned, and what can the people of BC see looking forward to this in 2018?
Well, anyone who's really interested in this, we have an online consultation process that's going on right now, and also an in-person process. Ravi's been all over the province to hear from people about what they would like to see and what their experiences have been in dealing with racism or discrimination in order to ensure that the commission reflects the interests of British Columbia. For people who aren't familiar with what a Human Rights Commission does, they usually are very proactive. They're out there doing education and advocacy to encourage people to be more tolerant, to identify and prevent racism and discrimination in, for example, workplaces and schools. So they're kind of an advocate that's out there encouraging people to be less discriminatory in their day-to-day activities, and to ensure British Columbia is a welcoming place for everybody. And it was disassembled in 2001, so we're putting it back together. If people are interested in providing feedback on that, they should go to the online process. All they need to do is Google BC Human Rights Commission consultation, and they'll find it. Ravi and I are also currently, in the next week or two, going to law schools across BC to talk to people at the law school. So if there's a law school in your area, and there's not one yet anyway in South of Fraser, But we will be at UBC, so if people want to do a little bit of a commute, I know we'll be welcome to that presentation as well.
For sure as well. I want you to also help our listeners out here. There was a tribunal that was in place that the commission was dismantled 15 years ago in favor of a tribunal. What's the difference between a tribunal and a commission for people that might not know what that difference is?
Sure. The tribunal is like court, so you can go and you can have your dispute heard there. There's an independent decision maker who's hearing your claim of discrimination and your concerns and making a decision about that. And the commission, though, is out there doing the education work and the advocacy in the community. And under the old model, the commission actually could bring cases forward to the tribunal, to the court, on behalf of certain people if there was a test case that they thought was particularly important that needed to be heard. Sometimes groups are unable to bring forward their own claims because they're of the nature of the discrimination they face, and so the commission can bring forward claims. This is something that the reestablished commission might do in future.
I know that this might not be in your purview, David, and again, I don't expect a direct answer on this one, but when it comes to a couple of different things here, before I let you go, the proportional representation conversation that's going to take place in the province of British Columbia over the next number of months is going to be a big one. There's no question about that. When you talk about changing the political process of what we do in British Columbia, it's certainly going to be a point of contention for people. Is it in your purview, from a government point of view, to make sure that no matter what is on that ballot as far as an opportunity is concerned, that there's also no, I like it where it is right now? Is there going to be that opportunity for British Columbians to say, we like what we currently have, as opposed to take one of these three new alternatives? Will that be on that vote?
Yeah, there will definitely be opportunity for British Columbians to refuse to change the system, to maintain the status quo. That's the whole idea of the referendum, is that people get to vote about whether they would like a change or not. But the actual question on the ballot is the subject of a process that we'll be rolling out over the next couple weeks. We're hoping that British Columbians who are interested in this, who have a suggestion about how we should be phrasing the question on the ballot, how it should be structured, will be providing feedback. This consultation process will be run out of my office. I won't be campaigning either for or against proportional representation. We'll be providing neutral information to the public about this, and the consultation will result in a report that is going to go forward to government. It'll be a public report with recommendations about what people want to see in terms of the question itself and how this thing should run. For example, should we be funding pro-proportional representation and an anti-proportional representation group so that they can get out there and make the arguments on either side? And we'll be guided in this work by a group of experts in terms of overseeing this process to ensure that it's a fair process. I know that it's a priority for British Columbians that it be a fair referendum, that it's not some sort of a sneaky thing that we're trying to get through to achieve a certain result. And we will do everything we can to ensure that British Columbians can have confidence in any result that comes from the referendum.
Well, and some opponents also, David, have said that why not a 60% referendum? I mean, it's a fundamental change in how we do our political process. And right now, it's simply a 50+1. Is there an explanation behind why 50+1 as opposed to 60?
Yeah, the vast majority of the members of the legislature are elected on significantly less than 50% of the vote. Most of the referenda that we look at, when we looked at around the world, we saw 50+1. And it seemed to us that setting the bar at 60% or higher actually favored the existing system. It was a vote in favor of the current system. So we thought 50+1 was frankly, it's more than most MLAs get. It's certainly a very significant margin of vote. And if 50+1 percent of British Columbians were in favor of a change or in favor of the status quo, that would be and should be binding on government.
All right, last question for you, David. And again, thank you for your time this morning, by the way. It's great to have you on board to have these conversations with our friend South the Fraser here on Pulse the Fraser. And in regards to the Massey Tunnel and the Massey Bridge and the whole Massey area, for that matter, we are all, and we've said this before on this program, everyone here, no matter what their political stripe, knows that something has to be done down in that area. It's a bottleneck. We know that more people are going to move down there. We know that the Massey Bridge project at this point has been shelved. We know there's going to be a commission put together to see what they can do, and Lois Jackson said she's in favor of that. What do you want to see happen down there as far as a plausible solution, and how fast we move on that solution?
Well, I mean, anyone who's driven through the existing tunnel knows that something has to be done. It's a real problem for commuters, and frankly, it's a problem for economic growth in the area if people are avoiding the area because they can't get through in terms of the existing infrastructure. What I think our shared goal is, what everybody's goal is a cost-effective solution to the problem. And the problem, from our perspective, is that the groundwork was not done to ensure that the solution that was put in place was not only addressed the problem, but was also cost-effective and appropriate in terms of a regional transportation plan. And so that's the work that's happening right now. We have an expert that's been retained who is going to provide us with that necessary advice. And it was always the feeling of a lot of people, myself included, that the previous bridge, the 10-lane bridge that moved to a two-lane road on the other side, was not the appropriate response to the problem, was in fact just something that the premier had thought up, and then all the evidence was created to support the premier's decision to build this bridge. We'd like to do it the other way, to have the problem clearly identified and to have an expert in transportation tell us what the best and most cost-effective solution is to the problem.
So if your expert does come back with the same thought process that the previous government had, you would move forward with that same process?
Oh, absolutely. The goal of this is an evidence-based process led by transportation experts to deal with the problem. And so if that's the solution, that's the solution. Our concern is simply that there might be a more affordable, more appropriate solution, and that wasn't explored. We need to use tax dollars responsibly, and we will do so.
I think that's the most important thing we can hear all day here, is that we talk about affordability on a regular basis, David, and if it means that we can get a crossing there, I don't think people care as long as they get one and it's affordable for everyone involved.
Exactly right.
Thank you so much for your time today, David. Appreciate it as always, and we'll have you on again soon.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Thank you. All the best. That's David Eby, the Attorney General of the Province of British Columbia. A number of different topics we discussed here on Pulse of the Fraser. Let's take a break. We'll come back. I will give you a bit of a traffic update next as well on Pulse of the Fraser.